Okay, the time is 8:34 a.m. on July 26, 2022, and I am convening this video conference and telephone conference meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the Association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on July 15, 2022 and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as all 8 appointed directors have been confirmed as attending in person or by video or audio conference. One director position remains vacant. And by the way, I think this is our first meeting with Mark Williams from National Farm Life Insurance Company. You there, Mark?
He is. He's just muted.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry about that. Computer issue here.
So also in attendance, our board counsel, Shelby Betts, general counsel, Jackie Rickson, the Guaranty Association, Executive Director Bart Bowles, and employees Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty. And from the Texas Department of Insurance, I believe we have Vane Hugo, Brian Rewey, Patty Otto, and Caitlin Merrick. I don't know about Kanisha or John Peters.
John, I'm here, Jim.
Oh, hi, John.
Hello.
Okay. So item number one, consideration and possible action on consent agenda items.
I move adoption of the consent agenda. I'll second.
Okay, we had Ted and Jim. Any discussion? Shouldn't with the consent agenda items, but okay. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. And I don't know if TDI has anything. The notes say you may not for right now, but
yeah, we don't have anything, Jim.
Okay. So then on to item number three, consideration possible action on reports from the personnel committee. James, you are up. And you do want to talk towards this microphone, I believe.
Okay. But we can hear you. It is on
me. Oh, it is on me.
Yeah, the personnel committee met on July 12th. All members were present. One thing to note that we typically do at the July meeting is to look at the insurance renewal proposals and rates, and those were not available for the committee on the July 12th. I guess I'm going to ask a question. I think, Topping, have we received those quotes yet?
We did. I'm sorry, I thought Bart.
I haven't. And I distributed those to the committee on July 15th. And if I can summarize what was in those quotes.
Thanks, sir.
And I have the actual comparative data that came out from our broker. But to summarize, our medical coverage through Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas did reflect a 10.06% increase in our premium level. That premium would go from $3,688.32 annually to $40,361.28. There were no changes in the benefits, no change to a different plan. So a 10% increase in the medical. Just let me touch on the others. The three other coverages that are through Lincoln, the dental, group life, AD&D, and the long-term disability, there was no benefit change. And we did also receive a 24-month guarantee that ensures this premium level is going to continue through next year. And we may see a change at our October 1st, 2024 renewal rate. So I think the renewals came in a little better than expected.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Now, when we discuss, is that something that we will vote on that?
No, this is normally a reporting item to the committee, and the committee say, okay, with that rate change or with the change in benefits, let's look, what other options do we have? If you find that their rates are acceptable and the benefits, we have no complaints from staff about the benefits, there's no action need to be taken, and I'll just move forward hearing no concerns being raised. I'll move forward to renew the coverages, and you don't need to take any action.
I'm definitely good with it. Jim or David, any comments from you guys?
No, I think that's great. Move forward.
Sure. All right. Thank you. We did have a update on the vacant staff position. That was one of the items in there. I'm not sure if we will that be part of a report that you give later?
I can just do it now. There's nothing confidential there. We're working. There's no we to it. It's Topping is working with a temporary agency. Although she and I did meet with them originally and kind of talk about what we're looking for in the skills for this person. So Topping's been working and reviewing resumes. She's had one person come into the office, spent a week with us, and just not a good fit. And so we've asked for additional resumes. So Topping, anything you'd like to add about your activities?
It's just difficult right now. I actually emailed the agency yesterday to say I'd like to talk to a lady they sent me information on, and they're like, oh, we were a few hours too late. She already got a job with some other place. And so it's just going to be difficult, our timing to, we'll find somebody. It'll just take a little while because the job market's good for people who are looking for jobs right now. Mm-hmm.
So that's all on that position.
And we just had some discussion about our January next meeting. At that time, we will be looking at the employment agreement and compensation for the for Bart's position.
If I could give a little foreshadowing on that, I think this may be important because it is, it impacts me, but also impacts staff and your compensation of your staff. We do tie our salary ranges that for each position to cost of living adjustments to from the Social Security Administration. It's put out every October and take effect January 1 the next year. So I take the salary ranges and adjust them however the cost of living moves. Last year, you know, that cost of living adjustment for 2022 was significant, 5.9%. Current projections show that, and this is always, they look at July, August, and September data. So they've just started gathering data to set the 2023 rate. Then they publish it usually the second week of October. But current projections based on inflation is that the cost of living adjustment for 2023 will be at least 7%, could be as high as I saw one report at 10.8%. So inflation and cost of living are looking to be substantial next year. And as that comes out in October, I will report it to the personnel committee. Okay. Now, as far as my contract, it's an automatic adjustment. And then I review and adjust the salary ranges for staff, and I bring that to you in January when we review them.
Yeah. All right, nothing else from the personnel committee.
Okay. Sorry. Then we're on to item 4. That's the Assessment Investment Committee.
So the Assessment Investment Committee also met on July 12th. Ted, Dean, and I, all the members were present. We reviewed the 2021 payments, 2022 cash flow needs related to the pending insolvencies, reviewed the remaining obligations. We have adequate funds on hand to meet those obligations. We reviewed the association's investments as of May 31, 2022. Most all these are invested in laddered U.S. Treasuries. We did talk with staff about kind of keeping in mind or track of the maturity dates for the investments involving Lincoln Memorial, Memorial Service, and have a little bit more on that in a moment. We reviewed the association's investment policy and charter. I did not recommend any changes. We reviewed the necessity for Class A and Class B assessments. Not recommending any Class B. So we have sufficient funds on hand to meet our obligations. We did not recommend a Class A assessment either, although the association does have a shortfall, I guess, for 2021, and we'll need to fund our 2022 needs. But we're not going to do that, or not recommending that we do that through a Class A assessment. Which brings us to two items. I guess the first involves discussion we had about handling the, I think, $48 million in Lincoln Memorial Memorial Service funds. As the board recalls, we've had some large litigation recoveries. We're expecting, as I understand it, some additional distributions from the estate this year or next year. So
we're thinking it won't happen until 2023.
We're going to wait until all the funds, or the committee's recommending we wait until all the funds are in before we make a final determination on what to do with those funds. But we did make some recommendations, I guess, for some interim steps. And I don't know if we just go ahead and do that resolution now. Barton, does that make sense?
If you want to describe these components, there are some numbers I could add to this as you get it up for discussion.
So we've got two resolutions for action items. The first has to do with the Lincoln Memorial Service Funds, kind of based on some discussion with staff. I guess as to the Lincoln Memorial Service resolution, we're recommending that the association directly pay member companies the amounts available, the amounts of available premium offset balances. So we have some companies, a few anyway, that have not.
Do you want any details on that now?
Let me run through it.
Okay.
So some companies haven't taken advantage of the whole offset yet, not many, but a few, recommending that we use some of those funds to fund the 2021 administrative expense shortfall and the 2022 administrative expenses. Those are items permitted by statute. Recommend reinvest the maturing Lincoln Memorial Service funds so that they mature on September 30, 2023. So if we need to make a decision at the end of next year, those funds will be available for action, I guess. And then to continue to monitor the collection of the remaining litigation proceeds and receivership estate distributions, and report back to the committee when we have all those funds. I think that's all captured in the resolution that's on 4.2, and I think it's on 4.3 as well, Bart.
So I think 4.3 is the, second resolution.
So anyway, I don't know if Chad or Dean or have anything to add, or Bart, did I miss anything?
Well, I just want to put some numbers to it so you know that there's $48 million sitting there, and what this resolution would take from that $48 million. Per our report from the comptroller as of May 10th this year, that's after this year's premium tax offsets have been taken, there are 64 companies that still have available premium tax offset balances from the four Lincoln Memorial assessments. And those 64 companies, what they've not taken, it's a total of $505,523. So out of $114 million assessed for Lincoln Memorial, there's $505,000 not taken as offset. So those 64 companies, 14 companies that have more than $10,000 in remaining offset available. So that's 89.5% of the total. And if you take the next 11 companies, so 25 out of the 64, you get up to 99%, another 47,000. So the remaining companies, there's actually 22 companies that would be paid less than $100. Okay. So the largest refund we would pay to a company is $86,675. So that $505,000 just cleans up. And we will report to the comptroller after we pay the companies that these people have been paid a refund, and the comptroller will remove any remaining offsets from them. So it cleans up off the comptroller's books and off our books, premium tax offsets related to linkable mortal. So that's part of it. The part of the the resolution talking about the Class A needs, we had an administrative shortfall that we would have assessed for this year with our 2022 projected administrative expense needs. The shortfall from 2021 was $1.2 million. We have borrowed $1.2. We estimate about a $1.1 or so million yet to pay in admin expenses this year. So this resolution provides that the 2021 shortfall and the 2022 admin expenses be paid from Linkable Mortal. It's about $3.6 million, we believe. So just wanted to give you those numbers, what would be coming out of the Linkable Mortal funds. In total, it's about $4.1 million.
Any questions about any of that? If not, I guess entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second. Yep. Okay. Any discussion? Okay. So all in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Jim, this is Shelby. I think since the audio recording are your official minutes, you should be sure and simply note that James Huckabee moved and you seconded.
Okay.
Any motions put first and last names. It's just for to help keep the oral record straight.
Yes. Okay. And then our, thank you, Shelby. Our last, second last action item has to do with an item on Memorial Life Insurance Company agent balances. And Bart, I'm going to have you explain this one briefly, if you would.
Yeah, I'll try to keep this very quick. Then, Jackie, if you want to fill in gaps, you're very involved in this.
Sure.
In 2012, the Texas Memorial Life Insurance Company receivership was preparing to close. This was another prepaid burial company. It was a Texas-only company. And the special deputy receiver had been pursuing outstanding unearned commissions and agent balances that are due back from agents. And throughout the receivership proceedings, have been trying to collect on those. The SDRA had negotiated promissory notes with four agents, and those were in process of being paid. But there were 29 agents that the SDR could not collect any funds from. So to facilitate the closing of the estate, and this is not uncommon when receiverships are trying to close, uncollectible assets can be assigned to the guarantee association. That's what happened here. There were 29 judgments that the receiver had obtained against the agents on these balances. Those judgments and four promissory notes were assigned to the association. So in the past 10 years, we have collected fully on three of the promissory notes, and one of the promissory notes, we got down to only $900 and just could not get the guy to pay any more money. On one of the judgments, it did pop up when one of the agents was trying to go through an employment process and get a new job, got in the way, of course, as liens like this can. And we were contacted, we negotiated a settlement with them and did a full release in exchange for a payment. This was a few years ago. But on the other ones, we have written to them. We've not had any luck collecting those funds. We've checked the license status of those agents on TDI, and they're not licensed as agents in Texas anymore. And when we originally were assigned these 10 years ago, we did work with TDI to see if there's something we could do through agents licensing to put some pressure on the agents. Long story short, we can't collect anything else on these people. So this is a request, and kind of a long story, but I wanted to give you the background of why it was on the balance sheet. It's about a $1.2 million asset on our balance sheet we want to write off. It's not collectible. We had already established an allowance for collectability for everything except the $900 on the promissory note, and now we don't even think we collect that. So this is to write those off and clean them off the balance sheet. It is something we talk with auditors about every year. What is that? We have to go through this whole story with them. We just can't collect anything else.
Mark, can I add something real quick?
Yes, right ahead.
So, and that is the reason why this is even coming up is the auditors recommended that if we have reached a point where we can no longer collect, that we need to write off. And I just want to clarify, Bart said it, it's a $982 hit to our balance sheet.
Hit to the bottom line. So you can take off the receivable and the allowance. There's a $982 difference that hit the bottom line.
The only other thing I would add too is, you know, at the time these judgments were assigned to us, they were basically duds already because, you know, the company itself and then the SDR had not been able to recover any of these funds from these agents. And so it's not like this was a great asset to be assigned to try and collect. So, and they haven't gotten better with time.
So to kind of address that, we've got the resolution, I think, is showing on the screen. It's on page 4-3. Again, it would direct the executive director to write off the receivable and allowance for collectability balances related to these judgments and notes.
We have a motion.
Ted Kennedy moves to adopt the resolution.
James Huckabee, second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
And that motion concludes the committee's report.
Okay, so is that it before we go into executive session?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So time is 8:57 a.m. on July 26, 2022, and I am recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association in order for the board to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. Okay, the time is 10 a.m. on July 26, 2022. The executive session of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association Board of Directors meeting has concluded, and I am reconvening the regular session of the meeting pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. So we have nothing. Oh, we're on to item number 9?
No.
Seven. Sorry. Yep. Six. Yep. We don't need number 6 because there are no items to act on. So we're moving on to item 7, which is Bart's quarterly report.
Thank you, Jim. A couple of items to mention. I don't need to say anything about COVID-19, but you can tell the way we conducted the meeting, how we're responding to it. But Jarrett and Topping and I are in the office all together one day a week. And other than that, we're staggered. We're in the office as needed when we have to deal with physical mail and other items. Wanted to mention the follow-up from the annual financial audit. Dean Frigo, Jarrett, and I had a meeting with Bhakti Patel, the partner of Clifton Larson Allen, to go over the audit, kind of wrap up. And several things were discussed and agreed should the board engage CLA to do another year's audit. There was a few things we agreed that should be conducted differently in the audit. First, Clifton Larson Allen would move up their schedule of field work by 2 weeks at least to allow for the work to be conducted, the draft audit report prepared and reviewed by conducted peer review before it ever goes to the audit committee. So it doesn't go to the audit committee, and then the peer reviewer have changes that the audit committee doesn't see. So we want to get as close to the final version before it ever goes to the audit committee. That's one thing. And then there were a couple of things that we are telling them we're working on that we're going to be changing in our GL. There are some proof of claims on our expenses and benefit payments that we continue to carry on closed estates because we still have obligations, but they're not valid proofs of claim because the receivership is gone. So we're talking about how we're reviewing those and what we want to define those a little bit differently. And the last thing is the obligations for the association for policies are something that I estimate monthly. So I do a thing called an obligation report monthly, and you'll see it in your packet in a minute. But all the background and notes that I have a process I go through, and there are some actuarial studies, and there are some other claims analysis, and I have different methods I use, but I prepare that. And the question was raised, could there be management bias in that? For some reason, I'm trying to misrepresent or represent inaccurately the association's obligations. So we're exploring how we might have an actuary review that, or at least have a discussion with me on the methodology I've used and give us some type of statement that the auditors can rely on the validity of those obligations estimates so there's no bias from me. So those are the things we did as follow-up with on the annual audit. Dean, you were significantly involved in those discussions. Is there anything there I've missed?
No, I think you got it all, Bart. The plan with the auditors, I think, is going to go a lot smoother with them starting a little earlier, and we won't have this gotcha with the second review.
Thank you, Dean. All right, so moving on. Again, Mr. Williams, thank you for being here. We welcome you to the board, and hopefully you'll find this interesting. It varies. No two insolvencies are the same, and our work, we like to say we do the same old thing, but we really don't. So maybe we can keep you interested. There is still one vacancy, and I know Caitlin at TDI continues to work on that public member vacancy.
Did I have a brain fart, or did we skip TDI exam?
I just kind of went over it. There's nothing to say. I can say it.
Oh, what time period does it end? Is it 2021 or is it 2020?
21 was the stated
end of it. Okay, so they have 18 months to do it, right?
Well, I don't know if that deadline is as strict for us.
Okay. They're
trying to put us in the schedule sometime in 2022 or 2023.
Okay. Sorry.
That's okay. I really didn't have much else to say. All right.
Jim, I was going to just say real quick that 18 month is for multi-state exams. So it really doesn't apply to your guarantee fund.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Uh-huh.
Okay, a couple of things I want to mention. This one is important. The Board of Directors portal. We launched that for this meeting. You all had your individual opportunity to go through training and set up with our outside IT consulting firm. I hope it worked well for you. For this meeting, we still use Dropbox. We are not going to discontinue posting the non-public materials. Excuse me, I said that wrong. Posting the public materials. They will be posted on the website. Continue. The Texas Department of Insurance personnel will obtain the materials there. Anyone from the public can, and you can as well. But we will also publish those public materials and non-public materials on the portal. And then there are, of course, you see other items on the portal if you've had a chance to look at it. So I urge you to use the portal. In my future notifications of upcoming meetings, I will put the link to the portal in the email so you can get to it. Now, what's going to be...
Y'all might consider a shortcut or something, because, you know, normally you can type like texaslifega.sharepoint.com. And it'll take you to your SharePoint. Well, that page happens to be a page that you can't access as a board member. You actually have to have this really long link to get to it.
I'll
talk to GCF. shortening that.
Bart, this is Patty. It would help to have a link because I'm on so many boards with so many board apps on my phone. I couldn't remember which one. And I went back through all the emails and nowhere did it have a link I couldn't find. So I ended up getting materials off Dropbox and printed them and brought them with me on my trip. I just couldn't remember how to find it.
Yeah, the link was in the email that the guy who did your training.
Right. And I couldn't remember his name. And so I get so many thousands of emails that I went through. I looked at Topping's emails, Bart's. So I just wanted to point that out. It would be helpful because I'm on four boards with four different ways of accessing information. I went to the Dropbox because it was easier this time.
Yeah, if there was something, a redirect like Texas Life or TXLifeGA.com/SharePoint.
Or we can include the link in Bart's initial emails to you guys because you can't get on it without your credentials. So we can always keep the link on the email.
There's nothing confidential about the link.
Yeah. Right.
So I will put it in future emails so you know where it is.
So it's always there. It's all right. And as long as you have your login information, you'll be good.
So please look at the portal. There's important information there. I think it's a much easier way to disseminate information. Okay, second thing, Topping has been working with the firm that hosts our website, GoDaddy, to redesign the website. And this is not update. This is not just to change the logo. Now we're using our new logo. It is a complete redesign. It will look completely different. We've spent a lot of time on the first draft, moving things around, looking to see what we want in pull-down menus, what needs to be on which page. And the next thing is we're going to be tweaking the final language, which we can do in-house. We don't really need GoDaddy to do that. There's a few places we're going to tweak some language. What we're using them for is how the website works and the shape of it. But it's going to look very, very different. The website has only been redesigned once since it went live in 2001.
So it was 2001, and then in 2010, I believe, the second.
All right. So we were the first Guarantee Association to have a website. And I think you're going to appreciate what it looks like. It will definitely be live before the next board meeting.
Yes.
How much is it costing to redo the website?
About $2,400.
Well, that's nothing.
Yeah. I don't think that was so bad.
I'm impressed.
Yeah.
I don't have to pay for female race car drivers.
That's. And then the last item, we've done some adjustments. I was concerned about the way we have our Azure server set up and access to, and the way they originally set up is you would have to connect through our firewall to get to our Azure servers. And I said, okay, if something goes wrong with the firewall, this building gets blown up and there's no power in this building and our firewall doesn't exist, we can't get to our Azure servers. So we've had a direct access remotely into our Azure servers that Topping and Jared and I have. So we have a couple of different ways to get to all of our files and information. Now that everything's in the cloud. As part of that, we are exploring how to make those files or what portions of those files available to the board. And it needs to be, I believe, the chair and the executive committee. When we were presenting the critical functions report, and there's a lot of processes in there, and we talk about here's where those files are located, here's where the tools to do this operation are located on our network, the comment was made, well, it shouldn't just be staff. The executive committee ought to be able to go find that information as well if they need it. So we're in the process of looking at, rather than just open up the entire, all our servers on the cloud to your access to see what information might be necessary or meaningful for you to see and how to organize it. So you don't have to go climb through all of our files to find what you're looking for. So we're going to go in and look at here's how we think it should be organized and what we think will be important for you to see, bring that back to you. Let get some feedback from you, and then we'll implement it. Rather than just say, it's open, go look at the servers. Well, there's a lot of stuff out there. And if you don't deal with it every day, you're not going to find your people. So we haven't dropped the ball completely on that. We just postponed it until we had some of these other processes worked out. Questions on that?
So something just occurred to me again, and it's fine to put the link in the email, but it is real easy to have GoDaddy set up.
Well, this isn't a GoDaddy.
No, well, wait a minute. Okay. Gotta let me finish.
Okay.
You can have what's called a redirect, where like you type txlifega.org/board, mm-hmm. and it will automatically redirect you to that link for the SharePort. Yeah. And then you don't have to go find an email and click on the link. I'm just telling you, it's
GCS.
I can do it in 10 minutes. It's easy to do. I'm not volunteering to do it. I'm just saying, I guarantee you they know how to do it.
Yeah, I am.
And it would make it really easy, because we would just know TexasLifeGA.org/board.
We'll get it. That will get done. That's not a problem. Just getting it built took some effort.
Yeah.
But I think now we're just going
to. This wouldn't be part of the SharePoint, though. It would be. Just whoever's doing your current website. It's just
no, it's not, because it's not a website thing. This is separate from our website.
Yeah.
So this SharePoint is not related to our website in any way.
But let me talk to someone who knows what they're talking about.
GCS, we will get it done, but it is not related in
any way. I know it's not related in any way. I'm just saying all that is a redirect.
We will get it done.
You type that in and it redirects you to the other website.
Thank you. But noted, we will take care of it.
Okay.
All right, meetings coming up. NEIC meetings coming up August 9th and 13th in Portland. I haven't attended NEIC meetings since pre-COVID. I am going to go to this one. There's a couple of things going on in the long-term care world. There's also some other matters kind of creeping up, but it's good to get back and talk to regulators in other states. So I don't know if any of you plan to, you'll be attending.
First time in a long time.
Yeah, I've been skipping those. And you know what it's like, the NEIC meetings, the hallway conversations are more meaningful sometimes than what's going on in the meetings.
This is Patty. I'm going, Bart. I mean, I'm planning on it. It's just that Portland is really hard to get to from Austin all of a sudden. It's like an over an eight-hour trip both ways for me. So
it's difficult. It's also it's a little sketchy in Portland right now. When you're there, just use caution. So
I'll be there.
Okay. IR meetings. There are going to be IR meetings at the NEIC, and I chair a couple of committees there that I've been doing the meetings virtually. So I'll attend those in person. There'll probably be a board meeting as well. I'm on the IR board now. The NOLGA NPC legal seminar will be held the next 3 days in DC. NPC meeting tomorrow, legal seminar Thursday and Friday. It's a desktop exercise on how to address a hypothetical insolvency. And so there'll be breakout groups among the in-person attendees and breakout groups of virtual attendees in teams working on, you know, learning how to address issues and insolvency. So it'll be an interesting exercise. We'll see how it comes out. And then the NOLGA NPC and annual meeting are going to be held in Tempe and on October 18th, 19th, and 20th. So if you're interested in attending that, let me know and make sure you get the information and materials. I will be presenting a long-term care panel with some case studies and interactive things for IR in Oklahoma City as well, I think at the end of October. I've done a couple of long-term care presentations from different groups recently, and this one's going to be more on claims management with hypothetical situations where you get online, everybody in the audience on their phones do polling, and so very interactive. We'll see how it plays out, but I've got a couple of members of the Davies group that are going to present with me. So that's what's going on in the meetings world right now. It looks like we're all settling into, I don't really call it post-COVID, but the new reality of how we do meetings in a still a COVID world.
What are the dates for the annual meeting?
Annual meeting, the NPC will be October 18th, and the annual meeting will be October 19th and 20th. And Jim, that's all I had to report.
Okay, then I guess we're on to item number 8. Is that you, Bart?
Yes. So quick summary. on the active insolvencies on 8-2 page, list of the active receiverships that are out there. And there are also some that we have ongoing obligations. And then the 6 being monitored at the bottom, I've mentioned that a couple of those have pending liquidation petitions that may come to fruition with the liquidation orders being entered before you meet again in October. As far as the obligations that we have paid over the first 5 months of 2022, only $132,000, almost $133,000 in policy obligations. We still have about $3.68 million that we have projected will pay on other active insolvencies. And please remember, Penn Treaty is not included in this. I'll report on Penn Treaty in a moment. And then we've received $63,000 in recoveries in 2022 and $25,000 in premiums. On page 8-3, this is the obligation report that I prepare monthly. I discussed earlier. It's different insolvency by insolvency, but this is something I provide to Jared each month. I have background notes of how I came up with these numbers. They're not just out of the air. And then he posts them on the in the financials. Page 8-3, I'm sorry, I just mentioned 8-4, is a report on consumer communications, whether consumers contact us about active insolvencies or general issues. But you can see in the second quarter, we had 618 phone calls, 57 email inquiries, and about 3,500 visitors to our website. And that's, I would say, topping kind of a standard volume.
A little bit more with the phones, but otherwise, yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, moving on, let's talk a little bit about a couple of the insolvencies. Penn Treaty and American Network. The only thing to mention out here, you can see that we've assessed $123 million for this. And net of distributions and recoveries, we have a net cost of about $111 million. So what has gone on? We funded our transfer our obligations to a captive reinsurer owned by the Guaranty Association system. We have paid nationally for all Guaranty Associations, excluding Illinois, Wisconsin, and Hawaii, because they do not administer their business through the LTC re-TPA. They administer it themselves in-house. So $471 million in collected premium, $1.24 billion in claims payments, and $133 million in cash buyouts. For Texas, about $27 million in collected premiums, $68 million in claims payments, and $6.5 million in cash buyouts. So you can see there are still 39,000, almost 40,000 policies in force nationally, 2,000 in Texas. So we're still moving along. That number has come down. As I mentioned, we started 5 years ago at 71,000 policies nationally. So we've come off 32,000 policies. And if you look at this item called exhausted GA coverage, you'd think, well, those people have fallen off because they've exhausted the Guaranty Association limits. No, only 505 policies nationally have exhausted Guaranty Association limits. There's only 1,000 policies nationally that have reached 75% of their Guaranty Association limit. So Guaranty Association coverage limits for long-term care do come into play. But when you hear people say that these policyholders are not getting everything they're entitled to, no, they're not getting everything. But most policyholders are getting taken care of in full. But that's something that I track. Actually, I have to track it monthly, and I report on it quarterly. The rate increases have slowed down considerably. I believe there were only, here it is, 83 letters distributed in the past quarter, in the second quarter of 2022, and 25 calls. So out of the 70, almost 71,000 packages mailed to policyholders, you can see there's about a 31% rate of phone calls and only 101 complaints have been received. My committee, the Policy and Claims Administration Working Group, looked at this volume, and the TPA had asked us to change their reporting from weekly to monthly. We asked them to back off their reporting to quarterly. There's just not enough volume. Escalated matters. This is something that a three-member group within PACA addresses. Escalated matters are not just complaints. It's any second-level complaint. So they've already gone through a complaint and then they appeal again, or anything with threatened litigation and or any complaint that comes through a regulatory agency. So those get escalated. We've had 209 of those since the liquidation. Some of them are fairly complicated. But what happens is the TPA gathers the information, sends over a summary, sometimes specific documents are attached, recommends an action be taken. The PACA review team looks at it and says, okay, before we send that to the guarantee association that's involved, you need to explain this further or add this document. Or sometimes they will just say, it's fine, we agree with the recommendation. So that goes to the guarantee association that's involved, and they have 48 hours to say, accept the recommendation or recommend something different be taken. It's worked pretty well. A lot of those regulatory complaints could have been really nasty situations, and they resolved quickly. Service level standards. This is the biggest news in the second quarter of 2022. COVID hit at a really bad time for the third-party administrator in Penn Treaty. So COVID started and really was hitting its I would say its first big peak in the first quarter of 2021. That's also when the transition to a new administration platform was being completed in the first quarter of 2021. So we had reduced in-person, in-office phone personnel and claims personnel. We had a lot of vacancies. We had problems in delivery of benefits. A lot of the home health care agencies stopped sending out workers, so these claimants couldn't get home health care. And so there was a flood of phone calls. There were a flood of issues trying to deliver benefits and administer these policies. So the TPA is responsible for 25 specific service level standards in our service agreement with them. My committee monitors those. I get posted online through a SharePoint site, a report every month, and then I analyze it, give my thoughts, send it to my committee. We do a formal report and upstream it to another committee. Since the first quarter of 2021, the Davies Group has had one or more misses on the service level standards. And you can see there are four specific standards I've missed. I've mentioned that they've missed. What's in red are what the Coordination and Strategy Committee, that's a committee I also serve on, my committee reports to that committee with our findings on the service level standards in the service, and then the CNS committee then decides whether to apply the contractual financial penalty or to waive it. So out of all those misses, you can see in the second quarter of 2021, there was a penalty on the call center applied where the standard for the average speed of answer, 85% of the calls are supposed to be answered within 1 minute. In the second quarter of 2021, only 38.5% were. Okay. Now, since that date, if you look at that one standard, you can see that it went up from 38.5 to 57.4, 76.9, 78.2. And then for the first time in almost a year and a half, they met the service level standard in the second quarter. With the improved performance and with the remediation plans that they provided to us, the CNS committee waived a lot of the penalties and asked them to reinvest those waived penalties into recruiting and compensating people in their call center. And it's paid off. For the first time again in quite a while, all the service level standards were met in 2022. Now, we have a number on both PACA and the CNS committee. We have a number of industry professionals serving on those committees. Several of them manage call centers. And throughout this period, they were looking at the call center reports. And they said the actions and remediation plans being implemented by the TPA are very appropriate. They're doing the right things. And they even said, we wish we could do as well on our call center as they're doing. So even though it looks like poor performance, they were outperforming really industry standards. It's been a difficult time. So I just want to point out, the administration is not something we just say, take care of it and turn a blind eye. We pay a lot of attention to administration. All right, two other things to mention here. Wellness pilot program continues to be implemented. As I had previously mentioned, it was rolled out in December of this past year. Patty was very involved in the committee in choosing the wellness vendor. assured allies. So let me tell you where we are. As of a status call I had with assured allies last week, 6,373 policyholders were offered the opportunity of participating in this program. 1,637 of them have responded and completed the questionnaire to participate. That's almost a 26% return rate. We have approximately, let's see if I can put in the report there, 1,637 of the policyholders, as I said, completed the questionnaires. 47% of those have been placed into the care process. So they're put into buckets of no touch, medium touch, low touch, high touch. Do they need some type of intervention? So 47% have been put into some type of care need. Interventions have already been offered to 160 policyholders, 351 different interventions. There can be multiple to a policyholder. It may be a grab bar and some counseling, or it may be a couple of different things in their, like a bench in their shower or something like that. So the whole intent here is that wellness pilot program allows that policyholder to age in their home with much better results. And yes, it probably will delay the need for care and the necessity or the intensity of that care. So it should be a win-win for everyone. The 6,373 people in the program, we also have a similar group, same size, that are not in the program, that is our control group. And we'll be measuring the claim results of both groups beginning at the end of this year to see, is it really bearing fruit? So it seems to be going pretty well. The last thing I'll mention, and I didn't put it on there, but I have it in my notes here. The responses we're getting on Assured Allies from the consumers is extremely positive. Most of you in the industry know a Net Provider Score. Okay. Net Provider Scores is an example. It's when you send back, say, are you pleased, somewhat, dissatisfied? You know, you do those things. So Net Provider Scores are assigned. You know, the 2021 average scores in the insurance industry for auto insurance, NPS was 41%. For life insurance industry, 39%. Contents insurance, 35%. For health insurance, 2021, the NPS score was only 27%. The NPS score we're getting right now on Assured Allies is 54%. So these people are very pleased. So what's some of the feedback we're getting? I listened to a couple of calls. One gentleman responded by phone and said, in this day and age when you can't get something for nothing, I'm getting a lot for nothing. Thanks a lot. Policy was not paying a dime for this, being paid for by the program. We actually had one gentleman send in a check. Sent a $15 check, said, thank you for this program. So it was sent back to him. It's no need to send anything, but appreciate your sentiment. So that's just two examples. There have been a lot of very positive feedback. So if that is also tracks through financials, this should be a very successful program. So that's the wellness pilot program. The last thing is electronic visit verification. This is not going to be a pilot program. This is going to be a program we're going to try to implement to all of the home health care policyholders and claimants that are on benefit or on benefit and receiving care from a private caregiver, meaning non-agency, or family caregiver. And on electronic visit verification, it does help tighten the reporting where people are not wasting benefits. They're paying a caregiver benefits that they are not actually receiving. And it does eliminate some fraud. Sometimes it's overt fraud that is identified. Sometimes it's just deterrent. There's 5 or 6% of the people that are offered an EVV program, they're on claim, they go off claim. Just the offer itself, it makes them rethink, do I need that care? So this is going to be a very, I think, I'm kind of excited about this program because I, as part of my group, we canceled the EVV program that was in place at Penn Treaty. They only had about 100 people on it. I was not very pleased the way it was being implemented. They had guidelines that were following, somewhat discriminatory. So we killed that program. We've just now gotten to this process to implement a new one. We developed an RFI, sent it out to three vendors, the three leading vendors in this field. They responded. We used their responses to kind of shape, okay, we had options on how to structure this program. We changed what we were offering a little bit, went back with an RFP. Those same three vendors have responded with their proposals last week. And then yesterday, we had calls with those vendors to refine their proposals, make sure we understood their pricing, look some examples of some of their screens for their apps, and how they handle certain situations. We will be reviewing those responses. I had emails while we were sitting here, about a flow of emails come through. In preparation for a joint PACA and CNS committee call on August 3rd with a recommendation to the NOLGA task force and to the LTC board of directors that meets on August 10th. So if we have a consensus and approval of a vendor, by then we will move forward with contracting with the goal of implementing January 1st. So once again, the Gearing Association system is being somewhat proactive in the management of a runoff block. And some of this has gotten a little bit of regulatory attention because I think two things. The regulators weren't aware that Gearing Associations do things like this. And then a lot of the things we're doing are cutting edge in the long-term care industry. And we're not going to wait. We're doing it now. So questions on Penn Treaty. Okay, quickly on Lincoln Memorial. Topping and Jarrett and I have done some research and cleanup on the remaining policies being administered by the SDR. We had a list. We thought we had 49 policyholders. We went ahead and started asking for all the images and all the system notes be dumped to us electronically so we could review them, prepare to put them into a system here so we could administer the remaining runoff and take it out of the hands of the of the SDR serving as TPA. In doing that, we found some of these policies had already been paid death benefits. Some policies were among those that had been assumed by other carriers, but our listings had holes. We filled in on the holes. So we now have 34 active policies, had 35. One passed away, we paid that benefit. 34 active policies. A number of those are in process of benefit. So the person is deceased. They were provided with the forms. They just didn't complete all the forms and send them back. So the benefits have never been paid. So they're really not active policies, but it's a pending benefit. We'll have to do some work on those. We also did obituary searches on some of the others because we found, I think, 12 people were over age 100, and we were able to match obituaries. The obituaries actually showed services were performed by the same funeral homes that we have in the records showing should have provided pre-need services and filed a claim. No claims were filed. So we'll be doing what we can to clean those up. And a lot of that may be cleanup after we transition it over to our administration. I told Topping because she handles, she's the first line. When the people call, they call her. So any gaps in data she has to deal with. At the end of the insolvencies, what's left is not clean. It's a mess. And even though there's 34 policies and she's looked at the records and the scans, it's incomplete and it's confusing. We have some that looks like this person has four policies. No, some of these were, Jackie, you'll remember, they converted them to term policies without the policyholder's knowledge. Those are in these records. That person didn't have a term policy. It's a whole life policy and they don't owe premiums. They paid it years ago. So that's the kind of thing we're digging through in these records. And it's going to be a messy administration, but we'll be starting on it.
When is the transfer going to take place?
Has not been set. I think we're ahead of the rest of the Gearing Associations because, you know, with 34 policies and we know the SDR well, we got the images pretty quick and we've been through them. The rest of the system that needs to deal with the remaining Lincoln policies, and most of them have more in Lincoln than we do, they've got to start down that road. I am assuming it's going to be sometime in 2023, but we will be at the front end of that.
And is there any way that you can, you know, take our 34 while the rest are still sorting their stuff out?
Yeah, easily take ours out of the mix. Now, we're not paying a lot to administer that business, but it's just to allow the receiver to close up the estate, close down everything they're doing.
Did all the ones where they did the malarkey of converting them to term policies, did all that get reversed so that people who had whole life policies got them back?
Right. They never told the policy owners anything. They just changed them in the system. But in the system, we have them flagged and we know where those are. And we have the records that we'll see the whole life policy, we see the application, and then later we see term. We even have records in that show. Here's all these silly policy loans that were never taken. It was just moving money within the company so they could steal it.
So are they pre-need? I know the policies aren't pre-need contracts, but they fund a pre-need contract. Those pre-need contracts still in force?
With the funeral homes, yeah. And that's the problem. Some of the funeral homes that are involved there may have transferred those pre-need contracts, or the funeral homes may not be in place. But we will use the claim payment mechanisms and the process we did to pay benefits all through this liquidation as we continue to run it out. So it's identifying and communicating with the funeral homes and with the claimants. And, you know, was these services provided? Has the family paid them or not paid them? The family's paid them. It's not going to the funeral home. We'll pay the family. So
back in 16, 17, I was out visiting funeral homes. Were the ones saying that they weren't getting paid, were they just full of malarkey? Or were they?
I think there's two things there. There were a group of funeral homes that were what we call orphan policies.
Yeah.
These pre-need contracts were sold with no associated insurance policy. So it's a pre-need contract out there by itself. And no, nobody paid those. The receiver is going to be paying them now with all the litigation proceeds. Second thing is, a lot of these funeral homes had pre-need contracts that had an inflation benefit. That, you know, they sold it way back when for $5,000 worth of services.
Yeah.
But the pre-need contract would allow them to get inflation up to the point whenever they pay the benefits. That inflation is not part of the insurance policy. The insurance policy only paid the face amount of the services. So they didn't get paid their inflation.
Okay.
So when they say they weren't getting paid, it needs explanation.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't make any sense what they were telling me. Curious.
Those are really what I call the extreme minority. There's not a lot of those.
Yeah.
For 150,000 policies across the nation. We had about 60,000 here in Texas. They almost all got paid.
Yeah.
So that's
60,000 in Texas, and we're down to 34.
Well, remember, we transferred 57,000 to as part of the assumption reinsurance transaction. We funded in July of 2011.
Okay.
That was a $95 million transaction. That moved a bunch of policies.
Yeah.
So 95 there, we paid about $34 million in direct benefits. So, yeah. You have to remember, this started in 2009.
Yeah.
So it's been a while. But that's Lincoln. I hate to take so much time, but it's at the end, you know, 34 policies, it's a lot of work at the end. Topping will tell you, she and I have been arguing back and forth. We look at the end just, what do you mean? Says, no, it says it's right here. No, it doesn't. So we compare notes after going through and comparing images, and it takes some interpretation. Anything you want to say?
No, just we need to make sure everything is noted.
Yeah. Topping saying, if we make a decision that we are going to, this is the policy and this is the benefit we're going to pay, let's make sure we put a note in there so we have to go back through all these images again and try to figure it out.
Note the false policies just in case somebody calls and goes, oh, no, this is my policy. I'm like, no, that was a term life. Not in case.
That's a good idea.
Note every.
So before we put them into the system, we're going to have all our notes made and those notes go in the system. So we're going to do this research once because it's hard.
Yeah.
Okay. Next company, Calanthe Mutual. This is the former fraternal that converted to a mutual life insurance company. We're running off. I would say topping the volume has slowed a little bit, but this is still something every week. Topping talks to a lot of consumers. Jarrett does too, but we have it on the QL admin administration system. So we do maintain reserves on it. We have paid 107 cash surrenders, 50 death claims. So you can see we paid out, it's about $108,000 in surrenders and deaths. We've collected 21,000 in premiums. And so we're down to 2,100 policies with a reserve of 801,000. Now, of those 2,100 policies, there's about 1,800 of those. We don't have addresses for them. Okay. So they have to contact us. They're not premium. We have less than 300 now, premium paying policies, approximately. So we bill and collect premiums on those. A lot of the way that the families find us is through word of mouth. So we put information out there in the hands of the worthy counselors, and that's the name for like the agent groups out there. It's not someone like Jackie, but she's a worthy counselor. It's a different thing. But we've contacted all those worthy counselors, and we've let them all know. And a lot of people have been finding us, and their families finding us. There are administration issues. It's an insurance company. Jim, your company probably does this all the time. You issue a policy, it's owned by a minor. I don't think you can do that, but this company did. We've got a lot of policies that are owned by minors. Now, grandma is paying the premiums. She's not a beneficiary. She's not an owner. She's just paying the premiums. We can't give her information. So who do we talk to? And if they want to surrender the policy, who's wanting to surrender? Who has the authority to represent that minor? That's one example. And that goes on and on and on throughout this one. So a lot of handholding, a lot of cleanup, but we've got good processes. Jackie's involved quite a bit. We have to do a lot of legal documentation of the processes we're going to follow. But this is going to be a block that's going to be out there for a while.
It's really hard to explain to someone who's mailing you a check every month that you can't tell them anything.
Right. Yes.
And they set it up. They probably intended to own the policy.
Yeah.
But that's not the way it was set up. And we can only go with the records we have. We can't ignore that.
So there's no application?
No. We have zero applications. Okay. Owner and insured, those two lines are not completed in the system. We have insurance. So the insured is the owner and nothing else. Now, the premium payer stuff, well, that stuff's fairly complete. But paying the premiums doesn't make you an owner.
Yeah.
But that's our problem. So it's a mess. We're working through it. It's going to be there for a while. The $801,000 in reserves, are you ever going to pay all that? No. Probably not. Okay. At some point, we may need to discuss what do we do with some of these policies that reach 110, 115, the insurers of that age. We're trying to go through and do obituary searches. We may want to engage a service, and there are a couple of services out there that accumulate obituaries nationally, and it's better than the death master file. So there may be another process down the road, but right now we're just, as people contact us, we clean up the mess and we get benefits out the door. And we talk death benefits, we're talking $100, $200. Most death benefits here are $375. It's not a lot of money, but to some people, it's enough money. All right, questions on Calanthe? That's all I have on the insolvencies.
Okay, then I guess we're on to item number 9, consideration and possible action on the corporate governance enhancements.
Right. Jackie had appropriately contacted me and pointed something out. That when we were doing the corporate governance, I called them enhancements in response to a letter from the General Counsel Department of Insurance. And Ted, you chaired the Corporate Governance Committee. When we were doing that work, and one of the things we changed or clarified and improved in our corporate governance procedures, one thing that was included was a significant focus to identify the fiduciary duties of a director and have those spelled out very clearly. Shelby assembled a very nice explanation that we have in the orientation materials for a new director. We now include those in an annual refresher to the board. I don't deliver those. Shelby delivers those and explains them and takes questions of the board. I don't know of another entity in the Guaranty Association system that does it to that degree. I mean, it's very nice. But Jackie pointed out, we've done a good job in assembling this stuff and Shelby drafted the information. That should probably be in the corporate governance guidelines. Let's put the fiduciary duties in there and document the initial orientation and the annual refresher. So that's what was updated in these guidelines. Jackie, you identified a couple of, I would call them grammatical.
Yeah,
and
not really substantive things. But yeah.
A couple of small changes that Jackie pointed out to me after I distributed the draft to you. I did not put them on the screen. I could, but okay. Is there anything there you want to talk about? I have your hard copy.
Yeah, so the only thing that I did, there were a couple of words that were kind of missed and that sort of thing. And then I added a statement. It starts in section 4 where it's the description of the fiduciary duties. I just added a little preamble that mentioned that fiduciary duties are not listed anywhere in our statute, and nor are they listed like in the bylaws or the plan of operation. So I just put a little introductory statement in there saying that those were not, the fiduciary duties are not found in statute, but they are, thank you, Bart, trying to do this from memory. Let's see. But that they are the same things that are listed in the Texas Nonprofit Corporation Law, and that these duties are likely applicable to TLHIGA directors. And so what I wanted to avoid doing, or, I wanted to give an indication of where these duties came from. And I think it's very likely if the board were to get sued over any of this kind of thing, the court would find that those would be the duties that would apply to the board. So there's not a solid line between these duties and the board of directors through our statute, plan of operation, or bylaws. But I think that's where you would end up. And so if, let's see. So where that says, that's hard to read up there, but where it says fiduciary duties, what I changed that to read is directors have the duty to act for the, the TLHIGA's benefit while subordinating their personal or company interests to the interest of the TLHIGA. While the act does not specify these duties, Texas Nonprofit Corporation Law identifies 3 such fiduciary duties, and these duties are likely applicable to TLHIGA directors.
Okay, forgive me just a second. Let me stop sharing that. And I have, sorry.
So really the whole idea was, we have these board of directors corporate governance guidelines, which were adopted in 2011 or revised in 2011 or adopted in 2006 or something. And so the idea was to just include some of these other things that have recently been adopted as a result of the letter from the TDI General Counsel and from the governance committee, and just incorporate that into these guidelines rather than have certain things, in a different place.
You know, Jackie, why isn't it sufficient just to have this documented as they are in the training materials? I guess my first reaction to this was it's kind of odd to incorporate legal advice into this document, which, you know, can change over time. And as you just mentioned, it was last looked at it, what, 2011? And yeah. I think the section on director orientation says, you know, you will be familiarized with your fiduciary duties and the role of counsel and the decisions that the ad hoc corporate governance committee recommended and the board adopted. I guess to me, if you're going to give this information to board members when they commence their service and every mm-hmm. year thereafter, you're by embedding that in the slides or the written materials, you have the opportunity to update it if necessary. And I guess I'm just more sensitive to laws changing given recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions, things that you are hard and fast and well established, sometimes are not as well established. So I guess that, you know, when you have the same material in two different places, there's the risk of it not getting updated in both places. And I guess I just, to me, yeah. your training materials are corporate governance materials.
Oh, that's okay. So the reason I thought it was appropriate to put these in here was, you know, what we talked about is that there's nothing in the statute that says what the duties are. And then if we're going to sort of adopt these duties as duties of directors, then my thinking was it made sense for it to go in this document where we have what the other, essentially duties and functions of the directors are. And I understand what you're saying, that the training materials are corporate governance as well. I just think it makes sense to, you know, put them all in one document like this. And I do think, yes, you know, the law can change, but I don't think these fiduciary duties for nonprofit directors is likely to change very much, just because they haven't changed in years, to my knowledge. So I think that's it's an important thing. I think it can go either way.
Are y'all seeing something shared, or is it just my device that says it's started sharing?
I can
sharing?
See it.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's just my device.
Sorry, Jim. I put yours up and then I couldn't see it on his screen, so I'll switch back.
That's okay.
Okay. Jackie, I'll let you control the conversation here.
Well, I think at this point, you know, the board can discuss whether this ought to be in here or not, or it can be something that you can, you know, table until our next meeting and mull on it a little bit longer.
Yeah, there's no deadline here.
Yeah.
This is just something.
You know, there, when you go to the section on director orientation, I guess now that you've, you know, when I saw this the first time, it's, you're making changes because of the ad hoc corporate governance committee actions, as well as just some cleanup. I would change director orientation to director training, because to me, orientation connotes, you know, something that you learn at the beginning of your job, which is true. But when you read on, it's like you've added, you know, each year you're going to get training on fiduciary duties. And also to be consistent, I think, with the TDI letter and the Corporate Governance Committee's actions, I would take out the orientation is strongly encouraged to delete the suggestion that it's optional, that this will be provided. I mean, I guess I don't know of any instances where people refuse to take the training, but I just think the optics of making it optional are kind of odd. And then if you're going to, you know, refresh this document, you know, I'd also talk about the required by law open meetings training that directors have to take, because meetings are conducted in accordance with the Open Meetings Act. I mean, I'd add that in.
Absolutely.
And then elsewhere in the document, you know, you talk about, I don't know where you would stick this, but there's no mention, I don't think, of the personal financial statement. And that's kind of a big deal. And since there's the header about what your conflicts and antitrust questionnaire, you could maybe add, by law, you're also required to file a personal financial statement.
Okay. So why don't we, if I could offer this to the board, why don't we take these comments and feedback and work up a new black line and bring it back to you in October?
Great.
Is that okay with you, Chair?
Yep, sounds great.
Thank you, Shirley.
You bet.
Any other comments?
No, this is Patty. Jim, I'm going to drop off, if that's okay. I think y'all still have a quorum on the last action items.
I don't think there are.
We're done on action items.
Yeah, we're done on action
items. Oh, we are? Okay, yep. Great. Thank you. Sorry, I'm going to drop off. Thank you.
Bye, Patty. Okay.
Or is there action on the 990?
The 990 is not required that the board approve it.
Okay.
In the 990 itself, there is an item that asks if the 990 was reviewed by the governing body and the entity. So you don't have to approve it, but we do make a practice that you have an opportunity to review the final version of it in the draft, confidential draft form, before we file it. Just thinking that, and we did distribute it confidentially to all of you. If there's any thoughts or questions, you would let us know. If you want a discussion on any of it, you have that opportunity at the meeting. But if we hear nothing, we would move forward to file it after this meeting.
Yeah, and this is item 10, by the way, for those listening.
Reviewed it, but I didn't make comments.
Yeah, I don't have any comments on it. Does anybody have any comments on it, or
no?
Yeah, not much discussion here, but Jarrett does usually have a few items to discuss with the outside CPA firm after he assembles it and sends it to them to review. There's always a few things that they want explanation on, so. There is some back and forth, Jarrett. Anything there of substance you want to mention?
No, there was just one small item on the expenses that we had to clarify. And then the CPA actually thinks that there should not be a reporting of my compensation on there. And I disagree with them. And so we kept it on there. I think in the spirit of openness and full disclosure, having it on there before and then removing it, I don't think it's a very good idea.
So there was an interpretive issue on there's a compensation range and definition of key employee that you have to go through, and those people have to be disclosed on one of the schedules. Jarrett has an interpretation of what that means, and the CPA has a little bit different. And we said, okay, what's the simplest way to resolve this? Jarrett, if you don't have a problem with including it, for full transparency, let's include your information. And that's what we've done. So thank you, Jared, for not having an issue with it. And that's all we have on that 990.
Then on to item number 11. We're reviewing the current financial statements.
These are the financial statements as of May 31st. Jared has a couple of items he wanted to point out here. Jared, you know, start there on the statement of net position.
Yeah, so on page 11, too, this was really quiet quarter, so not much here. At the end of March, we had a $1.5 million U.S. Treasury mature that was reinvested at the beginning of April. That's kind of our normal thing. If we need to keep money out of that maturity, we'll keep some or all of it, and then reinvest whatever's left over. That's really all on this page. If you want to go to the next one. So on page 11.3, the item I pointed out there is the payment of our ELIC installment that we have every year. This has really become kind of a non-issue, just the size of the payment. It's not much anymore, and I think it's even forecasted to decrease over time. So we may just end up not even reporting much on this anymore. Anything you want to add on that, Bart, about the ELIC payment?
No.
Okay. And so this is the last item to discuss here on the cash flow statement. You'll see a big jump there on the inter-account loans and borrowings. And that's due to us using the Lincoln Memorial funds to pay for our admin expenses in lieu of doing a Class A assessment. But the action that you took today on the Lincoln Memorial funds will repay those borrowed funds, and that number will go back down. And that's all I have, unless there are any questions.
I always like to point out the schedule. This is an interesting schedule. People always ask, what's the capacity of the association? You know, the 2% of premium, you can see there, but based on the 3 years, 18, 19, and 20, that the association has a $1.15 billion annual assessment capacity. That's a lot of financial backing behind failures of insurance companies that I don't know would ever be necessary, but it's something just to point out that disclosure is in the footnotes. And any questions on the financials?
And then we're on to item number 12, the calendar of activities.
I won't get into the calendar of activities. That's just where we track for the association as a whole and for the committees, the activities that have occurred and the upcoming activities and the events and issues to be addressed. And we just try to make sure we don't miss anything and they occur at the same time each year. So the calendar of activities is something that Topping posts on the portal. Because it's something that I've been posting on Dropbox, and I'm going to take it down. And we'll just post it in the portal. So at any time you want to look and see what are some of the upcoming events for the association or for a certain committee, we do put the items of the chair of a committee or the board. Those actions are in red. And so those are going to be on the portal. So with the schedule, we have indicated that the next meeting of the board of directors will be held on Tuesday, October 25th. Any regular committee meetings that occur in advance of that would be 2 weeks before. I believe we've done that for October 11th. Let me get the schedule real quick.
Yes.
Exactly 2 weeks before?
October 11th, Tuesday, October 11th.
Yeah, the audit committee would meet on October 11th, and the board would then meet on October 25th.
Do we have a time for the audit committee?
I believe we put it at, got it in the calendar here, 9 a.m., but that could be at any time that day. I mean, 9 o'clock, it could be 1 o'clock, it's just whatever the committee decides, but we just picked 9 a.m.
Does anybody have anything else we need to discuss? questions? And I'm going to read the language to close the meeting. The time is 11:07 a.m. on July 26, 2022, and this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that has been held pursuant to the Open Meetings Act is adjourned.